I'm Dan Rodericks of the Baltimore Sun, and this is Roughly Speaking, episode 418. Today, some civil rights history that's been overlooked. The role black girls and young women played in integrating schools and colleges across the country, even before the Supreme Court ruled that separate but equal was unconstitutional. In May 1954, civil rights attorney Thurgood Marshall, a Baltimore native and descendant of slaves, won his most famous legal battle for equality. The Supreme Court ruled in the Brown v. Board of Education case that separate educational facilities are inherently unequal. The plaintiff in that case, Brown, was Linda Brown of Topeka, Kansas. She was the 7-year-old daughter of a minister who tried to enroll her at an all-white elementary school near their home. After the school board refused to allow Linda Brown into the school, her father, the NAACP, and a dozen other plaintiffs filed a lawsuit against the Topeka Board of Education. Brown versus Board, the Supreme Court's ruling was a landmark. But before the Browns, before that case, there were many other African-American parents who tried to enroll their daughters in all-white public schools.
Parents were activists in every single state, especially in the Deep South and in the Midwest. They really were petitioning because segregated schools were untenable, such as they existed.
Rachel Devlin is an historian who discovered numerous cases of brave girls and young women at the vanguard of efforts to desegregate schools in the 1940s. This happened at the grassroots level, at the elementary school level. Efforts already had been made to integrate graduate schools and law schools, but parents who took their daughters by the hand down the street to the all-white schools forced the NAACP, Thurgood Marshall, and other civil rights lawyers to press the issue, eventually to the Supreme Court. Rachel Devlin is an associate professor of history at Rutgers University. She's uncovered some truly impressive stories in researching her book, A Girl Stands at the Door, about the generation of young women from Texas and the Deep South to Washington, D.C. and the Northeast, who desegregated America's schools.
I'm reluctant to use the word groundbreaking unless I can personally attest that what I've just read is groundbreaking research. But it sounds like you did break some ground here. You actually found some cases that people hadn't paid much attention to. Is that right?
There are some cases that people knew about and historians did not write about. But I also uncovered many new cases that have remained unknown until now.
And how did you do that?
So the first thing I did was I went to the Library of Congress and looked at the papers of the NAACP. And there were far more school equity cases than historians have known about. They were all filed in the late 1940s. Some of them were equalization suits. Others were school desegregation suits. The desegregation cases actually made an impact on the press. So those cases I could link up to stories in the black press, whether the Chicago Defender, the Pittsburgh Courier, but most importantly, the Kansas City Call covered all of these school desegregation cases in the late 1940s.
What really struck Rachel Devlin was the role girls and young women played in all of this, the daughters of parents who were angry at the conditions of the all-black schools and who believed it was time to demand equality in education. Boys and young men were involved, but in looking at news coverage at the time, Devlin more often saw the faces and names of girls.
I was looking at Ebony magazine. I was doing work on girlhood in the 1950s. So I simply pulled down volumes, you know, from the library, just was going through, paging through Ebony magazine. And I noticed that whenever they talked about a school desegregation effort, whether it was Sarah Lawrence or a school in the Midwest or a school in the South, the story was about a young girl or even a college-age girl. But they were all young women and girls. And so I thought, is this an editorial choice? They want to take nice pictures of cute girls, you know, or does this reflect reality? And then I thought, Brown v. Board was fought on behalf of Linda Brown. And then I thought about Ruby Bridges and some of the other firsts that I already knew about, Charlene Hunter Gull in Georgia. And I thought, gosh, is this a pattern? And it was, I didn't really believe that it was actually a reflection of reality. I thought it was editorial bias. But I went at that point to the archives in D.C., and then that's what got me looking through all these cases, and yes, it was in fact true.
I consider myself something of a historian, or at least a well-read person on this subject, used to believe that everything started with Brown versus Board of Education. That was the first big case, when in fact, these cases that you were just describing, desegregation or equalization cases, go back into the 19th century.
They do.
The period you focused on was after World War II, which I find really interesting, in the 1940s.
Mm-hmm.
There was school construction going on after World War II. There was a baby boom underway, right? You had to have schools for these kids who were born in the baby boom. But that was all going on in the white world.
Yes.
And that seemed to be the setting for this challenge to this system.
Yes. So plaintiffs and the NAACP waited until the war was over to file these suits. They had been waiting. They had filed some in the late 1930s. Gaines versus Missouri was decided in 1938. But once the war was on, they really stepped back from school desegregation. And the first person to file a school desegregation lawsuit on the graduate level was Ada Lois Sipuel in Oklahoma. Once her case was underway and received a great deal of attention from the black press, parents and daughters in states from rural Texas to Kansas to Washington, D.C., started to simply file school desegregation lawsuits. So there were a dozen that were filed in the late 1940s. And the NAACP had no intention at that point to file a grade school desegregation lawsuit.
Grade school. They were looking at college, graduate school, law school. This is Thurgood Marshall, right?
Exactly. And Thurgood Marshall in particular did not want to file a grade school desegregation lawsuit. He knew how difficult that would be to win in the Supreme Court. He was cautious about his record. He didn't want a loss, and he also knew that it was socially explosive in the 1940s. So Thurgood Marshall, he was the architect of a lot of aspects of the NAACP approach to legal segregation, Jim Crow, but he did not want to file a grade school desegregation case. All these cases came up through the grassroots, came up through lower courts in a diverse range of states. And finally, Thurgood Marshall had to be convinced to take grade school desegregation to the Supreme Court.
Why did he think they'd be tough to win?
Well, there was a lot of precedent for segregated schooling, particularly in Washington, D.C., where parents were very active. The parents went on strike in D.C. because the situation in D.C. was so dire. At Brown Junior High School, it was a school constructed for about 500 students. There were 900 students. They had to attend in shifts, student classes of 50 students, classes going on in hallways, in the janitor's closet. It was such a crisis. People don't realize when they think, oh, segregated, unequal, but people don't realize just how unequal it was. There were three competing grade school desegregation cases going on in Washington, D.C. in the late 1940s with three separate lawyers, quite competitive with one another. But the district in particular had put in segregation laws very early on in the 19th century and had renewed them periodically. So he thought it would be tough. He knew most of the jurists in the district. He thought they would be difficult to convince.
But why would grade school be more difficult than, say, a law school or an undergraduate school, college?
Well, the way they won the 1950 graduate school case is that they proved that even if you created two systems, a black graduate school system and a white graduate school system, particularly in areas like the law, but also other graduate schools, that there were what the court called intangible factors that could never be the same. You could not prepare a black lawyer to go out and litigate in a white world with white judges in a black law school. So when the Supreme Court ruled that segregation in graduate school was unconstitutional, they were thinking both about material but also what they called sort of social intangible factors.
Whereas at grade school, what difference does it make if they're segregated, basically? He thought that would be a tougher argument to make.
Yes.
Were you impressed at how grassrootsy this was, that these were parents who said, oh, they're building a white school over there. My daughter has to walk past that school to get to the black school. I mean, I'm simplifying this, but that's really what went on at the grassroots level, right?
Yeah, parents were very active, and it's quite impressive. They were active everywhere. So in some places where whites built a sort of gleaming new structure for white students, the black parents would just go stand in front of the school with placards, you know, and a bottle of water and just stay there all day and march in circles to protest. In some places, they petitioned the school board. In most areas where black students attended really shabby schools, and I'm talking, you know, shacks with outdoor privies, tar paper on the roof, parents were active everywhere and trying to gain access to more funding. Parents were activists in every single state, especially in the Deep South and in the Midwest. They really were petitioning because segregated schools were untenable the way such as they existed. Just to give you an example, in rural Texas, where they filed a desegregation suit, the Jennings family did, the high school that their daughters were to attend was an old German prisoner of war camp. And when the black high school burned down, they simply took the prisoner of war building, dragged it over to the spot where the old black high school had been, and propped it up with old tires. So when we're talking about, you know, unequal education, really what we're talking about is the educational system for African Americans really was not functioning at all. You cannot educate students in that kind of an environment. So that was one case in rural Texas, Hearne, Texas. There was another case, a very important case, in rural Kansas, South Park. And then there were three important cases in D.C. There was one girl, Constance Carter, who in Arlington, Virginia, simply tried to walk into the white high school in 1948. And when she was rejected, she filed a lawsuit with her mother. There was a case in Louisiana. Students tried to walk into schools in East St. Louis, Indianapolis, and in L.A. So there was just a lot going on.
Were you a little bit amazed by this?
I was amazed. I kept thinking that surely somebody else had noticed this, had thought about it, had written about it. And each year I kept working on it, I kept thinking I would stumble on something that, even something somebody had said at the time, mentioning that
there were all these girls.
All these girls who were mostly approaching these white schools. But it went unremarked upon in the papers of the NAACP and in informal interviews. No one talked about it.
Now, there were cases where there were boys involved, but like the majority of the plaintiffs would be girls.
Exactly.
Right? And there were some cases that were just girls.
Exactly.
So iconic to me are photographs or newsreel from, say, Little Rock, where we see some young women, girls and boys mixture, I think.
Six girls, three boys in Little Rock.
Right. So that's kind of an iconic image. So I do have in my mind that girls were involved in these things. But you have an impression that these are very well organized lawsuits and demonstrations and, you know, actually presenting at the school. When there were all these other cases that predated those. This would be in the 1940s where, what, parents would hire some local lawyer to file a suit?
Exactly.
Didn't go to the NAACP, right?
They often would file lawsuits with local lawyers. And those lawyers would often, after the fact, tell the New York office, you know, that their lawsuit was underway, or they'd ask the New York office for help. This is what kept happening in the late 1940s. Parents would approach these white schools, engage a local lawyer, and then that lawyer would start to petition the national office. Can we get some support? Can someone come down and help us argue this case? Can you look at this brief? And what happened is there were so many of these requests coming in that Thurgood Marshall started to realize that if he didn't take a case to the Supreme Court, somebody else would.
Why girls? Did these families choose the girls to step forward? Did the girls themselves step forward? I know there's a mixture of answers to that question, but why girls?
Girls were both drafted into school desegregation lawsuits and desegregating formerly white schools after Brown, and they also volunteered. The first and most important thing you have to attempt to desegregate a school is commitment to the idea of spending 6 to 7 hours a day, 5 days a week, 9 months of the year with white students. And you have to be able to imagine yourself in that space. girls disproportionately believed that school desegregation could be done and that they could do it. They had confidence in themselves. That commitment kept them going through arduous lawsuits and kept them inside white schools where there was backlash. Girls were good at it is the second reason. In order to approach a white principal who is hostile and angry and deal with the school board, talk to lawyers, speak to the press, you had to be poised, you had to be self-possessed, you had to be calm, diplomatic, and patient. What was most important was that the way that they spoke to the principal. So when girls and young women would approach these white schools, the principals always came out. They would not even let them in the front door. And they would meet on the front steps. You know, the white students would be pressed up against the window seeing what would happen. Usually the African-American members of the school that the girl was coming from, teachers, students, PTA members would stand on the other side of the sidewalk because it was so radical to see a black child walk into a white school.
And walk up to a white principal.
Yes. A good example is Marguerite Carr. The principal said, you don't want to come here. She recalled the incident saying, you know, well, I knew how to act in polite company. So I smiled and I said, I do want to come to this school.
This was in D.C.
And you see young women do this with white principals over and over and over again. So they are both friendly. She smiled, a sign of social reciprocity, trust, a willingness to engage. But she also stood her ground. So you have to be able to do those two things. So in disproportionate numbers, girls had both the physical courage, which you need to do any civil rights work, but also the social dexterity to interact with white adults in a way that was promising, that was productive.
And once they got in these schools, they endured all kinds of harassment, physical threats, and some attacks.
Yes.
Were those girls used to that from walking in and out of the white world anyway?
Yes. So girls had the skills to remain self-possessed, to carry themselves with grace when they're being insulted and demeaned. And they also lived in a world where sexual harassment on the streets by white men and white boys was constant. They were used to surveillance when they worked in white homes by white men and the white boys who worked in those homes. They were used to being in these intimate spaces with whites of all ages and both genders.
And hostility.
And they were used to that kind of hostility, but they were also used to difficult encounters. So they were used to moments where they had to be accommodating when they didn't want to, but they were also used to being confrontational when they needed to be, verbally confrontational. Never physically, this was not a possibility for them, but verbally. So the skills that they already had, just traversing in a white world, on the streets of a white southern city, being in a white home, those were already in place before they ever reached the schoolhouse door.
Are you ever struck by the fact there was just so much hostility toward black people? I mean, I know historically this existed. We both know all about the Civil War and Reconstruction and the years since then and the Ku Klux Klan. We know this history of racism and bigotry and hatred. But at some point you say, these are kids, right? And you think, why was it so hostile?
When six girls tried to walk into an East St. Louis high school, the students rioted and hung them in effigy and they were kicked and spat at. You know, when we look at, for instance, The Problem We All Live With by Norman Rockwell, we see a small girl in white from the ribbon on her head to her tennis shoes and four big marshals accompanying her into a school. And we see a child, somebody who is vulnerable and very small. But that is not how Southerners in the Deep South in 1960 saw her. They simply saw a black person. And one parent said, black students, and she didn't use that word, in my school will ruin my children intellectually, morally, spiritually, and every other way. And she genuinely believed that. She believed that black children would corrupt her white children. So I think it's hard from a 2018 perspective to understand fully what that hatred was like. The other thing that is important to know about the violence and the harassment and the endless ways in which these girls were ostracized in white schools when they desegregated in the 1960s was that they were being egged on by their parents. They were being instructed in how to harass them by white citizens' councils in the South, in Little Rock. Mm-hmm. And in New Orleans, the Desegregation First I spoke to said that the teachers were instructing the students how to respond to them in a hateful way. So some of it did come directly from adults who were overtly training kids how to attack black students.
It's an interesting point you make in the book about the way black girls were treated versus the way white girls were treated in the South, or actually anywhere during that time. White girls who were looked at in the wrong way by a black man or black boy, that person might be attacked for having just looked at a white girl. Black girls, on the other hand, could be harassed openly without any consequence.
Yeah, as one young woman put it, she said, you know, we never got any peace walking, just being out in public, no peace.
Did any of them give up?
So remarkable. No. Several were expelled for getting into fights with white boys, mostly in the lunchroom, involving food being thrown. But none of the young women and girls left. In New Orleans, the four first graders who started out as deseg firsts in 1960, they went on to also desegregate the middle school. And with every grade they desegregated, that grade became officially desegregated. At that point, the marshals were gone, the police were gone, they became targets. That was so violent in New Orleans in the mid-1960s that those girls did burn out, and one of them became ill over time, and they asked their parents, you know, can we leave? And at first their parents said, you know, just stick it out, you know, and for a few years they did. By the time they got to high school, they had transferred to a black high school.
Lucille Bluford, I wanted to ask you about her. Lucille Bluford in Missouri, who is a journalist, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm interested in her story.
Bluford got a degree in journalism from the University of Kansas. She lived in Missouri, but University of Missouri was segregated and she couldn't go there. But what they did is give you out-of-state grants to go elsewhere where they would accept you. So she went to where they would accept African-American students. So Lucille Bluford went to Kansas, got a degree in journalism, went back to Kansas City, Missouri, and began her career at the Kansas City Call. And from the very beginning, she was fascinated by segregation and attempts to desegregate spaces. In January of 1939, four Gaines had tried to get to enter the University of Missouri Law School. She simply decided to try to go to the journalism school, which was a very renowned journalism school.
Missouri, yeah.
Yeah, one of the oldest in the nation, internationally known. So she went and attempted to enroll. And she was turned away, and then she wrote to Charlie Houston at the NAACP, who was at that time the lead lawyer of the NAACP. And she wrote to him and asked him if he would take on her case, and he said yes. Lucille Bluford's case became kind of a cause célèbre among the NAACP, got a lot of attention in the black press in general. But she, at the time that she was attempting to desegregate the University of Missouri, was also writing articles about her legal fight, about her trips to the campus, about her encounters with white faculty, and was kind of recording it every step of the way in her newspaper. She tried to apply to the University of Missouri 11 times between 1939 and 1942. She was finally branded a nuisance by the school and barred from the campus, and they finally shut down the journalism school in 1942 in order to not admit her.
You had some instances where girls entered a public school and managed to be enrolled, but then white students completely shunned them.
Yes.
To the point where I think one girl was the only one in only student left in the school.
Well, in New Orleans, in the first grade, three girls, Tessie Prevost Williams, Leona Tate, and Gayla Chen went to McDonough 19, which is in the lower ninth ward of New Orleans. And they got there in the morning. The office didn't know what to do with them. They stood around for a long time. Eventually, they were assigned to a classroom. And the way the girls describe it is there was a surreal, evolving situation where the parents, one by one, would come in and take their child out of the classroom. And they all came, and the white students kept dwindling in number till by the end of the day, all of the white students were gone. And none of them came back for the whole school year. So they were alone in the classrooms, and they were not allowed to go outside because there were protesters and it was dangerous. So they would play in the stairwells. They would have lunch in a different classroom every day. It was an empty building.
For those girls whose lives you could trace into adulthood and that you got to interview, who was the most interesting and impressive?
First, I should say that these women, part of the reason that they desegregated because they were already incredibly well-spoken, incredibly bright, at the top of their class, confident young women who would have been valedictorian had they stayed at their black high school. So that they all went on to do amazing things is not too surprising. They desegregated the academy. They desegregated law offices, government offices, business. All of them went on to become desegregation first in their chosen fields. One of them desegregated the Oak Park Symphony Orchestra, which was conducted by Milton Prives, who conducted the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. Deborah Gray White desegregated school actually in Manhattan in 1963. She went on to become the foremost historian of women in slavery. She teaches at Rutgers University. Others went on to become principals. Really, all of them did amazing work as adults. It's hard to pick one out. I would say Ada Lois Sipule, who desegregated the University of Oklahoma, she promised them when she was finally accepted. She said, "I will spend the rest of my life proving that the University of Oklahoma made a mistake when they tried to bar me from their law school." She was so politically savvy. She always seemed to know exactly what to say. When she got a positive ruling from the Supreme Court on her case, she flew back to Oklahoma, and the Daily Oklahoma met her on the tarmac, and she said, "Justice is for everyone in the United States. It's a beautiful constitution. I'm going to be a lawyer. I'm going to learn." And she was so upbeat and confident and gracious and made this about a forward step for all Americans, not just for herself. It was so smart that the paper warmed to her and began to call her by name as opposed to the Negro plaintiff. And you could tell that she won over members of the white press corps. She went on to become a member of the faculty at the University of Oklahoma. Then she became a member of the Board of Regents of the University of Oklahoma. And her last act before retiring was to create an endowed professorship for Anita Hill. Ada Sipule was such a charismatic and politically active person that she ended up inspiring Anita Hill. And Anita Hill later claimed that she never would have made it through the Clarence Thomas hearings had it not been for Ada Sipule, who encouraged her the whole way, who said to her when she ran into her on the campus of the University of Oklahoma, "Anita, you're my kind of woman." So you can see the effects that these desegregation firsts had on history as we know it down the line.
Rachel Devlin dedicated her book to two women who were once among the brave girls who stepped across the color line in public schools, Betta Jean Bowman and Ruby Nell Singleton Strobel.
Betta Jean Bowman and Ruby Nell Singleton Strobel were two of the best interviews I did. And Betta Bowman was a desegregation first at Baton Rouge High School in 1963. And the way she talked about how she wanted to know that she was an A student, not only in the black school, but in a white school, in any school, and her ambition and the way she talked about it was so moving. And she talked about her father who worked at a petrochemical plant in Baton Rouge and how he always had to look down at the ground, say, "Yes, sir, yes, sir," you know, just to live, just to get by. And she recalled, he said, "Honey, just smile. So that you can live and get by." And she remembered that, and that for her, that was her motivation to go to Baton Rouge High and to desegregate. She died in 2017, just before the book came out. Ruby Nell Singleton Strobel was already ill when I interviewed her in 2009, and Strobel died in 2010, a year after I interviewed her. Strobel was just very emphatic about the moral urgency for desegregating the school. So she desegregated Albany High in 1964, class of 65, and she made an analogy to a soldier going off to war. So it was she who said, you know, I was never afraid. It was like those people who have a job to do. It's like soldiers who go over to the war to fight. The soldiers who go to fight for their country. It's the same sense. I'm going for equal rights, equal opportunities, and regardless of the outcome, that's what you go for. That was a beautiful way to put it, and I was very sad that neither one of them got to see the book.
Rachel Devlin is an associate professor of history at Rutgers University. Her book is A Girl Stands at the Door. The publisher is Basic Books. And that's our show for now. I'm Dan Rodericks of the Baltimore Sun. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again soon for another episode of Roughly Speaking.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at 6080 Falls Road, located at the intersection of Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. More information can be found at theivybookshop.com or by calling 410-377-2966.